Now, the next case for argument is Hegna versus the Islamic Republic. Mr. DuPont?
Yes, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Ralph DuPont. I'm a member of the bar of this court and of the bar of the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And at counsel table with me is my wife and law partner, Barbara Radlauer, and, of course, from the Chicago bar, Mr. Snyder and Mr. Cutler. The Hegna family's effort to collect on a judgment of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia was abruptly halted on April 24, 2003 by the intervention of the United States in these proceedings.
Counsel, could you tell me what the amount of the judgment that you received in the district?
Yes, Your Honor. The judgment was in two parts. For compensatory damages, it was $42 million. For punitive damages, $333 million. So far as I am aware, that's the highest punitive award in any of these cases. But otherwise, the compensatory damages are comparable in all the cases across the board.
And you were compensated in part from a fund. How much did you receive from the fund?
Total compensation paid, Your Honor, is slightly under $9 million, which is the proportional, not pro rata, payment that should have been made. So this is a pro rata computation and not proportional. We'll be discussing that again later.
All right, fine. Thank you.
In any event, at the time these proceedings commenced, no payment had been made, and no payment had been made at the time of the government's intervention, nor had any been made at the time the lien was placed on the property, nor had any been made up to the point where the chief magistrate judge decided that the government's motion to quash should be denied and a turnover order under Illinois law granted. What happened at that point was on July the 29th, a partial payment of a pro rata as opposed to a proportional share of certain funds designated as the Iranian Foreign Military Fund, plus certain proceeds from the rental property, some of which presumably came from this property in Chicago, among others, 12 of them across the nation. These funds were divided among five judgment creditors, and a 10% of those funds were reserved for a judgment yet to be rented in a case pending at this time in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, Kapar, K-A-P-A-R, versus Iran. Now, at the point in time where intervention occurred, my brothers of the Illinois Bar had a motion for a turnover order pending, and that motion would have been granted, presumably, but for the intervention of the United States. The United States intervention at that point was focused on a claim that the property was not subject to attachment or execution, the claim being that it was immune. Now, of course, this property had never been immune from attachment or execution, as I read the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act as amended in 1998, Section 1310 F1A, specifically would have made this property and all others like it subject to attachment for the purposes of recovering compensatory damages, not punitives, for purposes of recovering the compensatory damages element at least. And that legislation was interdicted by President Clinton, who on two occasions entered executive orders waiving the attachment and execution rights of American plaintiffs in our courts against the Iranian government. When Congress passed TRIA on November the 26th, 2002, it specifically deprived the president of any further power except on a case-by-case basis and prior to the enforcement of any order enforcing that judgment to waive execution or attachment. Now, the claim that is advanced here, and which is dispositive in my view of this case, is that the district judge, in reviewing the papers before her, was sidetracked to a claim that a payment had been made, and therefore relinquishment had to have occurred. She, I believe, failed to recognize, in this instance, the doctrine that the court must look retrospectively and enter its order non-pro-tunc to April the 24th if the government fails in its principal claim that the property is not subject to attachment or execution. And the government, as far as the chief magistrate judge was concerned, in his report and recommendation, failed to show that the property was used exclusively for a diplomatic purpose. And because of that, he concluded that, one, the government's motion to quash should be denied, and two, that a turnover order should issue. So in my view, the first job of the district judge ought to have been to look at that opinion and decide whether to adopt it or modify it, because the court would see fit, presumably. But presumably to adopt it, because I think the law is perfectly clear that this property is not being used exclusively for a diplomatic purpose, as the chief magistrate judge reported and recommended. Had that been done, then as I understand the doctrine of non-pro-tunc, since we were from April the 24th all the way into August waiting for a decision and going through the process of allowing the government to brief and argue its claims, not being held up in any way by anything we were doing, but being held up only by the U.S. government, the order then should have ended from the district court is non-pro-tunc, effective April 24th, this turnover order enters. Then her next question should have been, assuming the turnover order enters non-pro-tunc, is there relinquishment at that point in time? And the answer to that is no. There is no relinquishment at that point in time, because once the turnover order enters, as the district judge recognized, the property is then the property of the Hegnas. And no one in the government side, as far as I know, is claiming that once the property belongs to the Hegnas as a result of a court order, it has to be turned back merely because they received a partial payment. In fact, the entire message of the Congress in the trial legislation can be summed up very simply. Iran, you will pay these judgments out of the property that you have in the United States, including the condominiums which we found on our own here in Chicago. Those properties will be used to pay these judgments. And the oft-made claim that the United States is somehow paying these judgments is a gloss on the true state of facts, which is the United States made a choice at the executive level to accept an assignment of our judgment in exchange for 100% payment of that judgment for compensatory damages. And we, in turn, yielded up that judgment, and they, in turn, became subrogated to over $400 million worth of funds of Iran, which are part of a trust fund, literally a trust fund in my view of it, held by the Department of Defense and in the Department of the Treasury's hands, of Iranian money that came originally from deposits by Iran to pay military contracts.
How much real estate are we talking about in Iranian holdings in the United States?
To the best of my knowledge, the answer to that is in the magistrate judge's opinion, but it's also in the briefing by my brothers here in Chicago, and it's Exhibit 4 to our response to the government's motion to quash. I think it appears in the record at R23, if my memory is correct. But in any event, that is the Congressional Budget Office report, which relies upon information received from the State Department and the Office of Fire and Asset Control, and the number is $23 million. And may I say, Your Honor, in that connection, that the intention of Congress is very clear when you look at the overall scheme of statute, which is to marshal those assets together with these two pools of money which are in the hands of the U.S. Treasury. And when you go through that process, of course, you now maximize the benefit for not only the Higgins, but for each and every other judgment creditor. Because there would simply not be sufficient funds remaining of appropriated money with which to buy up judgments and pay 100% of the compensatory damages in the five cases.
What is that total of compensatory? You've got, what, 43?
I believe the total compensatory would vary somewhat, Your Honor, but my numbers are between 97 and 115 million, and I believe 115 million is correct, or a little closer to correct.
That's total?
Total.
Okay. And yours, I guess, you made the difference between, pro rata and...
Yes, Your Honor, I did make that point because at least on 15 occasions throughout the government's brief, they continuously speak of our receiving the pro rata payment which Congress authorized. Congress authorized no such pro rata payment. That is a fiction which has been created for purposes of OFAC's distribution of funds. The statute I'm referring to, Trier, amended the Victims Protection Act, which was the first round of payments made to any of these victims, the Flatow case being the principal one. But in any event, in that first round of payments, the funds that they were looking to were, of course, again, these two pools of funds. So in that round, they probably exhausted about $365 million to $350 million. It's difficult to know. We can't get this information. But something like that number was exhausted. So you would have roughly $53 million, perhaps, or $45 million, depending upon who you're talking to, left to pay these $115 million worth of judgments. Now, if you were to divide it up pro rata, then you would ask, well, who are the five persons who are making claims for this money? And then you would make a pro rata division. But that's not what Congress said. Congress, when it amended the Victims Protection Act, recognizing there would be a shortage of funds, specifically set down a formula in the Victims Protection Act, Section 2002, D. And in that proportional formula, they said, you must take the total number of judgments, not the total number of people making claims, and reserve for those people their proportional shares of all judgments. So now you had to take $42 million over $115 million, and not $42 million over, say, $97 million, and go out and pay somebody else money in some other proceeding, which is what OFAC did, in fact.
Is it your view, then, that Congress envisioned a rush to the courthouse?
I think they did.
Is that the intent that you think Congress had in mind?
They did, Your Honor. And had I been drafting the legislation, I wish I could have. I would have marshaled all the property so we wouldn't be here at all this morning, rather than let that be decided by a rush to the courthouse. We were only there a little earlier than others because we spent a lot of time in a courthouse.
Well, I'm not being critical.
No. I know you're right. No, that's exactly what Congress envisioned. And there had to be a rush because of the nature of the proceedings in this court, for example. We had to get here first as any judgment creditor would. And we only did that because we did a lot of research in the tombs of the United States District Court in the District of Columbia and found affidavits of the government there, which identified this property. But bottom line is, in our brief, we are saying that that disposes of this case when you look at it and enter judgment nunc pro tunc, and if you look at the relinquishment issue, that relinquishment issue is just a canard. It does not apply to the facts of this case. They have not made the payment. They have not paid the quid pro quo, which they're obligated to do. I see my, I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll pass.
All right. Thank you, Mr. DuPont. Mr. Barber.
May it please the Court, I'm Thomas Byron from the Department of Justice, here on behalf of the United States, the appellee in this case. With me at counsel table are Douglas Letter and Louis Yellen, my colleagues at the Department of Justice, and Lisa Grosch, an attorney advisor at the Department of State. I'd like to start by emphasizing that the Hegnas have actually relinquished, pursuant to statutory mandate, any rights that they might have had to execute or attach against the two properties that are at issue here, because those properties are at issue in a claim against the United States before an international tribunal. That's the reasoning of the district court in this case. It was correct and it's dispositive. We do have another argument, an alternative argument, that we put forth in the district court that the district court didn't need to reach, nor would this court need to reach, but I'm happy to discuss it if you like, concerning whether these properties are even blocked property at all, and they have to be blocked property for the plaintiffs to be able to proceed under Section 201A of TRIA. We say they're not because they are subject to the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations and they're being used exclusively for a diplomatic or consular purpose. But I'd like to begin with the reasoning of the district court and explain why it's correct. Section 2002 authorizes payment by the United States of certain amounts. Whether you call it pro rata or proportional doesn't matter. The statute says it has to be calculated in a certain way, and it was calculated in that way. The proportion of this judgment as compared to the entirety of judgments eligible for payment. That's what the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, the component of the Treasury Department that's charged with implementing this statute, was obligated to do, and that's what they did. That calculation led to a payment of over $8 million, partly from appropriated taxpayer funds to these plaintiffs, and partly from rental proceeds from the rental of these and other properties by the Department of State, which the Department of State has undertaken for more than 20 years. That payment had the effect of requiring a relinquishment, and the relinquishment covers all right, any right, to execute against or attach property that is at issue in claims against the United States before an international tribunal. And as the declaration by Ambassador Taylor, an Assistant Secretary of State, the Director of the Office of Foreign Missions at the Department of State, makes clear, these properties and other diplomatic and consular properties in the United States that are owned by Iran are the subject of a pending claim before the Iran-United States Claims Tribunal in The Hague. That tribunal was established pursuant to the Algiers Accords, which ended the hostage crisis in 1979 to 1981, and it's designed to consider and resolve various claims, including claims between the two governments.
Is there any property that's not so encumbered?
None that's in litigation at this point, Your Honor. We're not aware of any.
So it's all, I guess you'd say, protected or immune or whatever you want to call it.
Well, I'm not, I don't know, frankly.
Well, the reason I ask that, because the second question would be, are there any litigants who did not accept this payment and therefore did not relinquish the right?
There are some other judgment creditors of Iran, Your Honor, as well as some plaintiffs in pending cases that are not covered by Section 2002, in other words, that have not been paid, cannot be paid, and have not relinquished any
right. So what are they after?
Those plaintiffs, Your Honor?
Yeah. Are they trying to attach these or other properties, or how are they expecting, if they didn't accept this payment, how are they expecting to get any money?
Those plaintiffs are also pursuing execution or attachment of some of the same properties that the Hegnas have pursued. And in those cases, the second question that's presented in this case will have to be resolved, of course. There may well be other cases in the future. We just don't know, and that's why I'm not prepared to say categorically that there's nothing out there. But of course,
I would assume that the Hagnets were confronted with this decision to whether to accept and risk relinquishment versus going the route these other people have taken.
That's exactly right. In other words, Section 2002, which authorized payment from the United States of a portion of their judgment, of an amount equal to a portion of their judgment, that gave them a choice. It said you can accept something that is less than the full amount in exchange for the relinquishment of certain rights, or you can try to pursue execution or attachment. But what it said is you cannot do both.
Right.
And that's what they're trying to do here. And that's why the relinquishment argument is dispositive of this case. There are really only two questions that have to be answered to establish relinquishment. The first one I've just discussed, and it's established in Ambassador Taylor's declaration, and that is that the properties are at issue in claims before an international tribunal. The second one is whether any payment was received under Section 2002, and the Hagnets have acknowledged that they were paid in two parts, totaling over $8 million. That's also established in the record in the declaration of Mr. Richard Newcomb, the director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control. Once those two points are established, the relinquishment is complete. Indeed, as we explained in the district court, the relinquishment was complete with the payment at the end of July of the first portion. That's the way the statute's structured, but it doesn't matter here because now they've been paid the full amount that they're entitled to under that portion, under that provision of the statute. The Hagnets have not taken issue with the payment question, nor have they offered any reason to disagree or doubt the declaration of Ambassador Taylor, and there's no ground on which they could. Ambassador Taylor is an official of the United States government charged with ensuring that these properties are taken care of pursuant to the United States international legal obligations, and part of that includes knowing what is being litigated in that claim before the tribunal. That's established, it's irrefutable, and they haven't offered any reason to doubt it. I'm happy to address, if the court would like, the second argument, which is, as I said, is an alternative but need not be reached in this case. And it's a little confusing, I'll admit at the outset, because the standards are different for whether this is blocked property, but those standards arise from overlapping provisions of the statutes that are involved in the first question. So first let me be clear. The provision of relinquishment comes from Section 2002 as amended by TRIA. But the amendment of 2002 by TRIA is separate from the provision in TRIA that describes and defines what's blocked property and that in turn authorizes execution or attachment of blocked property. So I want to make clear that we're shifting gears and talking now about the TRIA definition of blocked property and more particularly about the exception to blocked property definition. And that exception says, turn to the statute for a moment. It does not include property that is subject to the Vienna Convention on consular relations, as applicable here, or that enjoys equivalent privileges and immunities, and that is being used exclusively for diplomatic or consular purposes. The government made clear in the district court, again in the declaration of Ambassador Taylor, that this property is subject to the Vienna Convention because it is property of the consular post. And the Vienna Convention, which we included relevant provision of in the addendum to our brief, expressly provides that property of the consular post is subject to the obligation of the receiving state, here the United States, to respect and protect in the event of a disruption of relations between the two nations that had consular relations. There was that disruption, and since the disruption occurred in 1980, the respect and protect obligation has been incumbent on the United States. The Department of State has fulfilled that obligation in a couple of ways.
Do you count that as a diplomatic purpose?
Yes, it is a diplomatic or consular purpose, depending whether you look at it as a part of the consular relations convention here, Your Honor. So mm-hmm. it, it, it's probably a consular purpose, but it's diplomatic in the sense that it arises from our treaty obligation, our international obligation.
That being to maintain the property.
I'm sorry?
To maintain the property.
That's right. The Vienna Convention speaks in terms of respect and protect. That's roughly equivalent to the domestic law provision that authorizes the Department of State to protect and preserve.
Could they sell it, Mr. Byron?
If the Department of State concluded that that was the best way to fulfill the obligation, yes, they could sell it.
The preserve value, would that be the argument?
Yes, I believe so.
In the real estate market, that would come under respect.
There could be a variety of ways. There is a provision in the Vienna Convention itself, which I believe we did not reproduce here, that specifies when sale can take place. If I recall correctly, and I apologize, I don't have that provision with me. I could speak to that separately if the court's interested. That determination has not been made, though, by the Department of State.
No, I'm aware of that.
Sure.
I just want to see how far the argument goes. That's all.
There's certainly a very broad range of authority that the United States has to fulfill its international obligation under the Vienna Convention. And it's eminently reasonable, for the reasons that are set forth in Ambassador Taylor's declaration, to conclude that renting the properties to third parties is a reasonable way to respect and protect them in order to preserve their value. It prevents deterioration and break-ins, et cetera. Occupation does that.
How are those funds allocated, the rental income?
The funds are used in the first instance for upkeep and maintenance and repair. Any additional funds that are left over after those obligations are met are put in a bank account, and Ambassador Taylor's declaration explains the accounts and how they're maintained. That bank account is also blocked, and it's been those bank accounts have been the subject of other litigation, including by the Hegnas. The funds that are in those bank accounts are being preserved as well. There's a dispute between Iran and the United States about whether the United States is fulfilling its obligation under the Vienna Conventions, and this is how we say we're doing it. But it's unsettled with Iran.
None of that's been paid to any of the plaintiffs currently.
The funds that had been accumulated as of the date of enactment of TRIA were used, I'm sorry, as of the date of enactment of Section 2002, I apologize, I'm getting, I need to be clear about that, were designated by Congress for payment to judgment creditors, including the Hegners, and they were used. Those funds accumulated up to that date of enactment were used for payment to the judgment creditors, yes. Funds that were accumulated after that date have not been paid because there's no statutory authority for doing so and because they are blocked, and they must remain blocked and preserved. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes. Are the tenants there now?
Not at the moment, Your Honor. Apparently, the tenants left upon posting of a notice that the property was subject to attachment liens. And the Department of State is, of course, considering other opportunities to rent it out, but at the moment, they're vacant. If the court has no further questions, we believe it's well established in the record that the Hegnas have relinquished any right they might have had to attach these properties, and that indeed they had no right to attach because the properties are not blocked under Section 201A of TRIA. So if the court has no further questions, I'd urge that the judgment of the district court quashing the writ be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Byron. Mr. Dupa?
There are a few things that I would like to set the record straight on. First of all, at the very end of counsel's argument, he made note of the fact in response to a question from the panel, I believe, as to what was going on at the properties, the Chicago condominiums, today. And the answer is they are vacant, and they are vacant because the lease has expired. The lease of one of these expired prior to the attachment, while the turnover order was pending, the second lease expired. That is my understanding in any event. I don't want the panel to think we're driving the tenants out and diminishing by $1 any money that's coming to Iran from these properties, because that is exactly what is going on here. This is, again, a facade that money is being used to maintain the properties. As you heard counsel concede, millions of dollars have been accumulated in a fund for Iran out of these rentals, and those millions have indeed been used to pay or buy up judgments in part. So far from being an exclusive diplomatic use, because they like to talk about diplomatic purposes and diplomatic use, but not exclusively, this statute says this property must be solely used for diplomatic purposes if it is to qualify. But it can't qualify at all unless, in the first place, it's subject to the Vienna Convention, or one of them. Now, these are residences here in Chicago occupied, apparently, as another proceeding some years ago here, in which it was acknowledged that these properties were occupied by employees of the Iranian Consul General's office. So I wouldn't have you think this was the home of the Iranian Consul General, but rather these are employees who have the benefit of these apartments. So how this gets to be subject to the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations is impossible to understand. It certainly can't. I don't think even the government claims that. So it must be subject, if it's subject to anything, to the Vienna Convention on Consular Relationships. But how it gets subject to that is impossible to know, because it has nothing to do with the consular post, nothing to do with its records, nothing to do with its archives. It's merely the place where the security guys live.
Well, isn't that supportive of the mission, though?
Well, in the broad general sense, it may be supportive of the mission, Your Honor.
You're not running a restaurant there.
Well, I hope not.
I mean, it would seem to be in the range of reasonable support facilities to house employees of a mission.
Judge Flan, I agree with you that certainly we see that over and over again in. I'm just learning about these things myself, but we see it everywhere we look. But the bottom line really is, what was Congress trying to do here? And they say Will Rogers used to get the newspaper and read to the audiences in the theater what the Congress had done that day when he ran short of any local material. Now, what we have here is this interesting claim that the Congress of the United States, having previously enacted a statute which subjected this property to execution and attachment, and which the president then exempted, passed a law which they cleverly devised so that first, you could attach the property. Second, the president, under no circumstances, could block your attachment. But third, and most important of all, they then define blocked assets so that you couldn't attach the property. So this entire body of law called TRIA is just nonsense when it comes to the subject of attachment and execution.
Well, what do you view as the congressional intent regarding the relinquishment issue?
The relinquishment issue, the congressional intent is very clear, and that was another, I felt, misstatement in my opponent's argument. Congress said you can, in fact, do both, and you should do both. You should both make the application for such funds as are available, and you must, in addition, proceed with the attachments and executions.
So they had envisioned, as you say, Mr. DuPont, that following the course you suggest, that you would go about attaching, receiving whatever judgments until such date as full payment of your claim is, in other words, till the administrative process played out, and received that final check, you could be about this attachment process.
That is exactly what Congress said, Your Honor, and the statute expressly provides for that procedure. I see the red light is up, and my time is up.
Right.
I thank the court, and we ask that the district court's judgment be reversed and remanded, and the judgment be directed.
Thank you, Mr. DuPont. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.